my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. Bicycle Talk, episode 405, to be broadcast on Wednesday, July 24th, 2024, on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk with my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. If you are watching on Facebook Live, please feel free to comment. We should be able to respond. Bicycle Talk is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show and are listening on Facebook Live, you can comment on the Bicycle Talk Facebook page right here, or you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on WHUS.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. Ron's Rant of the Week. New York City, what a surprise. Governor Hochul's congestion pricing pause helps rich suburban drivers. You know, this she just can't stay out of my rants. Her little guys certainly have big wallets. Meanwhile, the rest of us suffer while declining subway service and buses that are slower than walking. Thanks, Kathy. So, anyway, that's the backwards direction of government when somebody who is more influential than the normal people get involved. We'll move forward. Not trying to make a political statement, but I think I just did. What's the height of a hood of a pickup truck? I've been through this one before. I'm going to go through it again because it's just starting to make me more and more angry because every year they get a little bit taller. So many vehicles are more than 40 inches tall at the leading edge of the hood. And on some large pickups, the hoods are almost eye level for many adults. So what are we doing? What are we doing here? Are we making vehicles that will basically eliminate cyclists from the roads? This is ridiculous. Someone needs to get involved with this. It seems like the consumer products protection people would get really, really involved with this. Maybe even the CDC, you know, causing accidents that are killing people and things that kill people. The CDC gets involved. I'm gonna complain about it. So it's called truck bloat. But of course, this and more in the show. On a positive side, here come the Thread City Quiet Corner Rides. This Sunday, come and explore the quiet roads of northeastern Connecticut. These are the roads that we ride on all the time out here and that we are always talking about as wonderful places to ride your bike because of the lack of cars and trucks, and it's beautiful country roads, and yeah, you pay the price in the hills a little bit, but you also get to see some beautiful, beautiful country, and you don't see a lot of cars out there. So if you are not doing anything coming up this Sunday, it is on Bike Reg, and you can sign up for it, and we would love to see you this weekend on Sunday for the Quiet Corner Bicycle Rides. I'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to events, just to give you the breakdown of what we have available later on in the show. The Tour de France, over but not forgotten. So many firsts, and I have a whole list of that coming up too. This was a very interesting Tour de France, and there just were a lot of things that happened in the Tour this year that were firsts for various reasons. But I have some other stuff we can talk about too, and we'll get to that. Walking and bicycling are affordable forms of transportation. Many studies have shown that support for the investment in pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure results in economic benefits for individuals, businesses, and communities. These benefits also are linked to other areas related to health, safety, the environment, and more. Interesting, huh? Have you not heard this before in the show? Probably hear it every week, I'm sure. But to go with the positive side on this, just so we go positive, Massachusetts has a $58 billion budget agreement, which is going to include fare free regional transit. How about that? That's a big push in the right direction. So how do you get cars off the road? You offer free mass transportation for people who are living in cities. What a brilliant idea. We should do this more often. It just makes sense. I mean, you ride your bicycle in the city, it's free. You ride the train in the city, it's free. You ride the bus in the city, it's free. Why would you want to own a car? Makes sense, doesn't it? My son doesn't own a car. He lives in Chicago. Hasn't owned a car since he moved there. And he's doing just fine without it. So, you know, once you figure it out, it's really a good thing, because you really don't need them as much. So, I got some trivia questions here. I'm going to throw these out here for starters, and maybe Fran will get people responding on this. We'll see. Trivia: who is the only American to win the Tour de France? Okay, we're going to discuss this later, so I'll give out the answers later on. Who is the only American to win the Giro? And who are the only cyclists to win both the Giro and the Tour de France in the same year? And who successfully linked the Giro and the Tour on no less than three occasions? In 1970, 72, and 74, the rider who has achieved the most times. Later in the show, we'll get to that. And unless you've been living under a rock, Fran, you're not living under a rock, right?
Depends
on what rock we're talking about. Well, President Joe Biden dropped out of the race Sunday.
Yeah, he did.
And endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris. Mm. So, what does this mean for transportation? Well, we'll talk about that later on in the show, too. Mm. So, and what is RAGBRAI? RAGBRAI is Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa.
It's happening right now at this minute.
More than just a bike ride. It's an epic 8-day rolling festival of bicycles, music, food, camaraderie, and community. It's the oldest, largest, and longest multi-day bicycle touring event in the world. Cool, huh? And shout out to my friend Helen, who's at RAGBRAI right now.
And Bill Penn's
at RAGBRAI.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
Great. So we have some locals that went to RAGBRAI. It's supposed to be just an absolute hoot. One day, maybe I will do it. We'll see. The longest ride on RAGBRAI is like 84 miles. Because I know that Helen was very concerned about that. Because she goes, I don't know if I can ride 84 miles.
And you don't have to do, they have a variety of distances each day.
Right. There are a variety of distances. So anyway, RAGBRAI, that's a positive thing. That's cool. So let's move on to Ron's mechanical minute and tips for the week. So it's almost August. Hard to believe, isn't it? It's almost August, so you've been riding your bike. You've been riding your bike all summer. If you're up here in the northern states like we are, this is the time of year that you get a chance to really get out and go on your bike and, you know, put in the miles and put in the time on your bike. And what's your chain looking like? Good question. So I do discuss this often on this show. Usually bring it up at least once a season. And your chain is going to gradually wear with use, and it will need changing from time to time in order to maintain your drivetrain's performance. So worn chains ship poorly, wear sprockets quickly, and sometimes break. How long should a chain last? The answer is all up in the air. Depends on a lot of different factors, but on the average, we're going to pull the old on the average, like the 220 minus your age thing, 1,500 to 3,000 miles. 3,000 is pushing it. 1,500, I'll talk a little bit more about it. So anyway, from what I have pulled up today to talk to you about is expect between 1,500 and 3,000 miles for an average multi-speed chain. It helps to establish what counts for worn out. A chain is worn enough to affect transmission efficiency when it lengthens by more than 0.75%. But has some life left in it, you can extend the mileage a little bit more. But basically, if it lengthens by 1%, you're probably got a worn-out chain. So how do you know what that is? Well, if you were very meticulous about when you put your chain on, measuring the chain, then you'd be able to do that. But they also make these nifty little chain checker tools that will help you with that. They'll help define whether or not your chain is worn or not. And I think that's probably the easiest way of doing it, because you can actually do a chain checker right on while the chain is on the bike. You don't have to take the chain off. Some people take the chain off and then they hang it from, in my workshop, it's from a finishing nail on the side of my cabinet. And then you can measure it from end to end, and you can see how it is that way too. Why would you take the chain off? Maybe you take it off to clean it. That's why you would take the chain off. Otherwise, you leave the chain on. So that's why the chain checker is probably the most efficient way to do it, because you can just leave the chain on and you can do a substantial amount of cleanup on your chain while it's on the bike if you take your time with it and all. But that brings me to the 1,500 and 3,000 mile marks, okay? And I find that at about 1,500 miles, my chain is probably starting to wear pretty good on my road bike. That would be on my road bike. If it's on my cyclocross bike or if it would be on a mountain bike, you're talking entirely different numbers here, because you get so much grit and grime mixed into your chain from what you're picking up off the road that, you know, it does wear the chain faster, or especially if you're not meticulous about cleaning your chain. I'm not meticulous about cleaning my chain. I clean my chain enough, but not too much, is what I call it. So I like to keep a little bit of, not grit on the chain, but enough lube on the chain that it's going to, you know, be quiet for a long period of time. So anyway, 1,500 miles is usually a good marker for, okay, my chain's getting kind of worn out now, and then what do I do? Well, you know, depending on who you talk to, some people say, like there was a comment here from a listener that said, my chain broke, so I brought the bike in. The guy told me, well, why don't you, well, you don't have the old chain, but we'll have to replace the cassette also. So they go together. Now, he said that it was a fairly new chain, and he was not real happy about that. And so that's why he said, what's the numbers? And this is what brought up this discussion today. So 1,500 miles is pretty good on a cassette. And then you, if you put a new chain on that cassette that has 1,500 miles on it, you can usually get another 1,500 miles out of it. That's what I find. So that brings you to that 3,000 mile mark, okay? I've been known, if I'm really diligent about it and careful about keeping my chains pretty clean while they are on the bike, to be able to go yet another 1,500 miles on another new chain. So I'm saying that every 1,500 miles, if you replace that chain, put a nice new clean chain on, make sure the cogs are all clean, make sure your cassette cogs are clean, your chain rings are clean, and you're just putting in a new clean drive train, that you can go as many as three chains per one cassette. And that, once again, is determined on riding style and body weight, maximum wattage put out on your bike. There's a lot of little factors here. I find that if you are like me, and you tend to be more of a spinner, someone who uses lower gears and spins his legs around a little bit faster, putting less strain on the chain and on the drivetrain, that you will get more life out of your bike, out of your bike drivetrain. And so that's my suggestion. So if your chain is not cleaned regularly, it will attract and hold dirt. That dirt will act like 50 grit sandpaper on everything it touches. When a chain stretches out, it'll wear the cassette equally. So anyway, this particular comment came from another shop, and they said that they like to go through about 2 chains per cassette. Now, the cassettes are quite a bit more expensive than the chains are, and that's why you want to try to keep the cassette alive for a little bit longer than the chain, because the chains are far less expensive. And that's usually, so they go with every 2. So every 3,000 miles, you're replacing a cassette. I know people that ride their cassettes, 6,000-7,000 miles, and their bikes sound like crap when they're riding them too. They don't sound good at all. And, they really probably need to replace it. And the biggest fear I would have in not having a chain replaced is if I'm climbing a hill and I'm out of the saddle and I'm putting a lot of torque on it and it's a really badly worn chain, if that chain breaks, that's going to hurt. That's all I can tell you. It's just not going to be a pretty day, and you can get pretty hurt. You could even fall off the bike at that point. You could crash your bike. I don't recommend pushing the limits that far. So anyway, like I said, 1,500 miles is a great rough guess. Depends on how you ride. Some of us can ride more like 1,800 miles before replacing a chain. Some people can only ride about 1,200 miles before replacing a chain. But again, it does depend on your riding style. The folks that I know that are have a tendency to push big gears and be spending a lot of time putting a lot of torque on their chains, those chains are going to wear out a lot quicker. They're definitely going to. Whereas if you are a cadence person and you're spinning, spin to win, that's what they say, then you're definitely going to get a little bit more life out of that chain and out of the cassette too. So they all definitely they do wear together to a certain degree. So anyway, that's my chain cassette story for today. Once a year, I think I talk about chain cassette stories, or maybe sometimes twice a year when we're talking about winter overhauls and that sort of thing. But, so last week I talked about, advocacy, facts about the National Highway, Traffic and Safety Administration, which had talked about 783 pedal cyclist deaths and 753 involved single vehicle accidents with automobiles. Not good stuff. So I wanted to bring this up because it seems that there is a rapid rise, as well as with people that are not living through their experience in motorized vehicles or outside of motorized vehicles. 42,000 last year deaths in the United States by motor vehicle. So it's not just the cyclists and the pedestrians that are having the problem. It's also car on car or truck on car or SUV on SUV, whatever you want to call it. But people are just driving poorly. And the more they drive poorly, and I think it has a lot to do with the distraction that's happening inside of automobiles, which is really annoying to no end. And brings me to a few other things that I talk about often on the show too, and that is the visibility of the cyclist. And if you're far off to the right-hand side of the road, you are invisible to the car that's coming up behind you. So get out in the road so that people can see you. And then when the car comes up from behind, you can scoot over then. But don't hide yourself on the side of the road and then have an unexpected car try to pass you and another car is coming the other direction, and then you get squeezed off the road. That's not good. You want to make sure that you almost have to become your own personal traffic cop when you're on your bike if you want to ride safely on the roads today. And so I have found that putting myself more out into the travel lane on my bicycle and then moving over once the car sees me and, you know, we basically communicate silently with one another. I know you're there, so now I'm going to go over. Or I'm not going to go over because there's a car coming the other way, and I'm not going to go over until after that car passes, so you don't have a head-on collision with the driver from the opposite direction or squeeze me off the road. I think that you can ride a lot safer if you just get your butt out in the middle of the road. Get out where the cars see cars. That's the key right there. If you ride where the cars aren't looking, then you're going to increase your possibility of being hit by a car coming up from behind. And of course, you know I am a huge, huge believer of this. And unfortunately, my battery went dead on my computer this morning when I was riding. And so I lost my rear radar because of that. But the rear radar is a lifesaver. It's a game-changing system that makes a huge difference when you're riding your bike. And there's more and more systems coming out now, so you don't have to just buy the one from Garmin, and you can get them from other vendors now too. And wow, what a huge difference when you know that car is coming up from behind, and they know that you know because the flashing on the actual light itself that you're carrying behind you increases as the car gets closer to you. So it's a brilliant design, a brilliant idea, and it's yet another way to command a little bit more respect from the distracted driver that's coming up behind you. They do respond to distraction for some reason. They respond to the screens in front of them, and then if they see something flashing in front of them, they're going to respond to that too, because it's almost like their brain is already like programmed to do that sort of thing. So get your butt out in the middle of the road. But anyway, that's my advice to you. Anyway, I think that it really, really helps. And let's see. That brings me to truck bloat. So truck bloat is killing us. So this is a new crash test, which is being revealed. All right. And the hood heights that are 40 inches or higher are 45% more likely to kill a pedestrian or a cyclist. And they're all coming through that way. Now, to go along with that, it's not just the height of the vehicle that's going on here. There are other factors that are involved here. And the reason I bring this up is because American car buyers just can't seem to get anything big enough to drive in. I don't know if it's because they're too big to get into a small car or if they just have this fascination for extra large vehicles going down the road. I don't understand. I even know people that, this is kind of a funny story. I know people that bought these gigantic vehicles and they can't fit them in their garage. Believe it or not, they have a garage and fit their old car fine, but now that they have the giant SUV, they can't park the car inside anymore because they're going to have to like modify the garage or rebuild a new garage to be able to put their car inside. That's kind of funny, actually. I think it is. But so crashes that involve vehicles with hood heights that are 40 inches or higher are 45% more likely to result in a fatality as compared to vehicles with hood heights that are 30 inches or less with a sloping profile. Now, this is the thing here. There's different profiles in the front of vehicles now, too. And these big, pickup truck and boss looking SUVs, they're all square-nosed and big blunt-nosed vehicles now. So they're doing this because apparently it is a style issue. It's some sort of a fashion statement to have something that looks behemoth. I'm not quite sure. I don't really understand the liking for any of this stuff. And I even have trouble with the fact that I try to drive as small a vehicle as I can that's practical for me. And even my small vehicle is a little big. You know, it's just a little big. I want it big enough so I can put, what else? My bicycle in the back, of course. But, you know, they just keep making them bigger, and that's kind of annoying. And then you get some car manufacturers who are building some of the most popular cars in Europe, and they can't even bring them into the United States because no one wants to buy them. So say the car dealers. So say the car dealers. Not this consumer, but the car dealers. So if you were watching over the last 3 weeks, you've been watching the Tour de France, you're going to see lots of these little cars that are, they're wagons. They're like little, they're sport wagons. Basically, they're the old VW sport wagon. And there's Volkswagen makes also a car under a different manufactured name called a Skoda. And Skoda is the primary sponsor of the Tour de France this year, so that all the vehicles were Skoda vehicles. But they're all these small wagons. And I can tell you right now from experience, because I've owned a bunch of them, and when I was a rep on the road selling bicycles and bicycle parts, I could put 4 or 5 bike boxes in the back of one of these wagons, and everything fit really good because they're like designed more intelligently than the small SUV is. And the people that had the small SUVs couldn't fit anything in the back of their cars, even with the seats down. They had a really, really difficult time. So it's all about whether or not you can get a bike in the back, as far as I'm concerned. If I can't put my bicycles inside securely, I don't want the vehicle. But anyway, this standard, this 40-inch high standard, is moving into a lot of the very, very popular SUVs that are out on the road too. So this just makes it a lot more difficult for people that are vulnerable users, like cyclists and pedestrians. And that's why I bring this up, and that's why I talk about it a lot. I'm hoping that someday someone will listen and they'll hear this and they'll start making a big stink about it, because it's really maddening to me that it's called deadly by design, if you want to really define it. So here's your baseline. There's a 30-inch vehicle height, which is available with sedans primarily, okay? And they have a low-sloped front end. So if you can take, as an example, I could put something like a Toyota makes a car called a Prius, which is a hybrid, and it has a very low-sloped front end. Funny story about a Prius. I saw a number of years ago a Prius that was following a little too close to a much larger truck-like vehicle in front of it. I think it was actually a pickup truck. And they rear-ended the pickup truck. And when they rear-ended the pickup truck, they literally wedged themselves underneath it and put the pickup truck up on the nose of the vehicle. It's pretty funny. It was, you know, it was obviously no one move because something's going to flip and fall, and that's going to be a problem until the wrecker gets there and tries to sort it all out. But it was, and all the traffic was all backed up, and I looked over and I saw this, and it was almost comical because of the low profile of the car and the high profile, the back end of the large truck, and they didn't match real well. So there's a couple of different styles for cars, and one is low sloped and one is low blunt, and it has a similar risk. Medium sloped has a similar risk, and that would be a 30 up to 40 inch front end, but with a slope on it. And the difference between that and a medium blunt, which is more of a boxy front end, is it ups the liability of impact by 26%. And then tall sloped, and that would be the 40-inch top, ups the liability to 45%, and tall blunt to 44%. So this is it's not just the height of the vehicle, it's also the way it is designed, the actual boxiness of the vehicle. So anyway, it's a little maddening, and I only ask that if the next time you're having a discussion with someone who's looking at getting a new car, you might mention that you're a cyclist and you're very concerned about this height situation, and if they could please consider the fact that, you know, it's not just the people on the inside you're protecting, but the people on the outside too. All right, I'll leave it alone now. That's enough. I've played around with this one enough. But it drives me nuts when I see stuff like this. So we went over the drivetrain longevity. We did that. And now we're going to move on to a few more things. Like let's go to the tour. That's it. I got to go to the tour. I'm halfway into the show. It's time to talk about the Tour de France. Have you been watching the Tour de France? Has anybody, well, if you've been listening to me over the last couple of weeks, you obviously know that I'm very excited by this. And going into the tour, I think, was more exciting than going out of the tour. And I had that discussion this morning with Billy on the phone. And mainly because going into the tour, there all the variables were still open. And then as we got closer to the end of the tour, it was obvious who was going to win the tour and how amazingly different and outstanding he was when it came to the final stages of the tour, or even the final week of the tour. So let's start with firsts, okay? So firsts. What's that country that Binyam's from?
Eritrea.
Okay. Eritrea's Binyam Girmay. Okay. Eritrea is a dot of a country in Africa. It's a little tiny spot in Africa. It's over on the east coast of Africa, northeast coast. And it's this very tiny country that is apparently really excited about bicycle racing. And Binyam Girmay has he's made history. First African to ever win a stage of the Giro d'Italia. That was his first one, okay? First African to ever win a stage in the Tour de France, followed by a second stage, followed by a third stage, followed by the first African to ever finish in the green jersey, the points jersey, in the Tour de France. And not going up against anybody who's just, you know, who, it wasn't like there wasn't competition there. Even Mark Cavendish was there and he won a stage. And that capped off his career, and pretty much that was the end. That's the last I think we will ever see Mark Cavendish in the Tour de France, because it happens. We get old. And so, you know, we're not quite as fast as we used to be when we get old. And so Mark has hit his mark. He has won more stages in the Tour de France than anyone else in history. Yes, that includes Eddy Merckx. But he is not Eddy Merckx. We'll get to that in a little bit. Huge. I'm a big Binyam Girmay fan. He is the most humble sprinter I have ever listened to in an interview afterwards. He's kind of amazing. Going on to firsts, the first Ecuadorian to wear the polka dot jersey, climber's jersey, Richard Carapaz. Richard Carapaz, not only did he wear that, he also wore the yellow jersey for one day, I believe, in the very beginning. He's an Ecuadorian rider. He is a young climber. He's just kind of an amazing rider, and he has a lot of talent. And, you know, it was really, really cool to see him finally take command of the polka dot jersey, which is the climber's jersey, if you're not familiar. And he was the fastest guy in the mountains with the most points in the mountains, which was kind of cool. And amazingly so, because the person that was fighting for number one with him was the winner of the Tour de France with Tadej Pogačar. So they were kind of battling back and forth, and then Richard finally took it, and I think that's just wonderful. That's really, really cool. So there's a first. He also climbed on stage 17. He climbed to a solo victory in the Tour de France, which was really amazing. So another first. Here we go. Tadej Pogačar is the first cyclist in this century to win both the Giro and the Tour de France. This guy is amazing. There's obviously he is a very, very talented rider. He won his first Tour de France when he was 20 years old. He won his second Tour de France the following year when he was 21 years old. He's young, he's strong, he's then along comes Jonas Vingegaard, and you know, things changed, and of course the Visma team, and they kind of worked him over, and so they won two stages of the Tour. So we had two riders going into the Tour de France, both very young riders going into the Tour de France this year, that were both two-time winners of the Tour going head-to-head with one another. The difference is that Tadej Pogačar came off the Giro with an outstanding lead win, and we thought maybe, we meaning people I discussed this with, thought maybe he would be too tired to win the Tour de France. But on the other hand, the person who was going up against him, who had as good a chance to win, was suffering from or recovering from an injury that he received in the Tour in the Basque Country back in early April. And Jonas, he crashed bad. He punctured a lung. He spent a week or more in intensive care because of that. He had broken ribs. He had a dislocated shoulder. He had, or maybe a broken shoulder. He had a broken collarbone. He was just a mess. And he was seriously thinking, and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago on the show, he was seriously considering not racing bicycles anymore because it scared him a lot. And, you know, he was thinking about his family, and he was thinking about his wife, and he just, you know, he was going through a lot of reflection while trying to heal himself. He never raced his bike after that until the first day of the Tour de France. So there's another story. There was just so many stories involved in the Tour this year, more so than I've seen in the past. And, you know, he hung in there for a long time. I got to give him credit. He did hang in there for a long time. But Tadej Pogačar just looked like he had an extra gear. That's the best way I can put it, is he just had better legs and an extra gear. And he went on to win not one stage of the Tour de France, but six stages of the Tour de France this year. So he is the first in this century to win both the Giro and the Tour de France. And then, so we'll get to more of that in just a minute. So in the early part of the show, I asked, who was the only American to win the Giro d'Italia? Anybody know? Anybody taking a good guess out there? I don't see anything on my comments here.
Can I guess?
You can guess, sure.
You said American?
First American to win the Giro d'Italia. Oh. And only American to win the Giro d'Italia.
Greg LeMond?
Nope. It was not Greg LeMond, but that's a good guess because
he won everything.
It's kind of in that same era. And I remember the strategic stage of which he won it, and it was snowing so hard on the top. They were in the Alps, they were in the Italian Alps. It was snowing so hard. And Andy Hampston from Colorado apparently rode in snowy alpine pass rides in the past, and he literally left everybody behind. And
I have no idea who that is.
Yeah, so anyway, I think Eric Brooklunk won the stage. Brookink run the stage, but Hampston's efforts put the pink jersey on his shoulders. He wore it for the remainder of the race, and he remains the only American to ever win the Giro d'Italia. Interesting Andy Hampson story. I was at, there was a small bicycle shop in Fairfield, Connecticut, when I was a road rep. And Andy rode for the Motorola team, I think, back in the day. And I was in there. They did a ton of repairs. They were, and they did, worked on a lot of high-end road bikes and that sort of thing. And Mark, one of the owners, said to me, "Hey, Ron, I got to show you something. This is so cool." And what it was one of his customers had purchased one of Andy Hampson's team bikes. And so it was, you know, all painted in the colors and the team colors and all. And right on the top tube, it said Andy Hampson on the top tube, because they identify their bike. They need to put their names on the bikes. And I said, "Oh, wow, this is really cool. It's really one of the team bikes." He said, "Yeah, they were auctioning them off." And so my customer bought the bike and brought it in here, and we're going to work on it. And I said, "So what's the story on the bike? Has he like changed anything on it at all?" And he goes, "He hasn't touched it. He hasn't touched it since he bought it." And I said, "Can I sit on it?" Because, you know, the guy won the Giro. I want to sit on his bike. Who knows? This might have been the bike that he won the Giro on, or it might have just been one of his spares. We don't know. But anyway, I sat on the bike, and the whole shop, all the guys in the back, just went completely silent. And I looked over at them, and I went, "Oh, my God, it fits." And they went, "You fit on Andy Hampson's bike perfectly." So it was just kind of, I guess he's built like me, basically. Climber, skinny, light, strength of, you know, good strength to weight ratio. But anyway, but I was never going to be Andy Hampson. But anyway, that's an Andy Hampson story. So who is the only American to win the Tour de France? Fran?
The only American to win the Tour de France?
Yeah, the only American to win the Tour de France.
It would be Greg LeMond.
Has to be Greg LeMond. Yeah. Absolutely. It is Greg LeMond. And yes, there were other Americans who finished first in the Tour, but they did not win the Tour because they were expelled from that because of illegal activities, doping activities. So unfortunately, there were two others, but they don't count. In the record books, they don't count because they were expelled from the Tour. So yeah, it was Greg LeMond. And Greg LeMond was also the rider who introduced the aerodynamic position to the Tour with a set of Scott bars, which were these U-shaped, weird-looking aero bars that went on the front of his bike. And when he beat Laurent Fignon that year, 1989, I think it was, he won by 8 seconds. It's the closest Tour de France win ever in the history of the Tour de France. Pretty cool stuff. Anyway, sorry I'm a geek. I love following bike racing. I love the Tour de France. It's really kind of a cool thing. I like all the race, all the classics, but the Tour has an exceptional piece to it. And I was looking at my Facebook page this morning, and Dave Hildebrand is, I guess he must be over in France for the Tour de France, because he was amongst the parade of cars that they were all preparing to go out and do the caravan that they do before the Tour goes through town. And he was standing around and all. It was fascinating. It was a great picture. Thanks, Dave. I appreciate that. That was really, really cool. He shared it on Facebook. It's kind of fun. If I find it, I'll share it back over to Bicycle Talk, because I thought it was kind of cool. So here we go. Only 7 cyclists have won the Giro and the Tour in the same season. The first one in this century is Tadej Pogačar. So now we have 8. All right. So I thought that this would be kind of a fun thing to talk about, just because it's a fun thing to talk about. So the difficulty of successfully linking both races is very, very high. Okay, so only 7 cyclists have achieved it, and there were some great cyclists out there that have done that. It was the first to achieve it was Fausto Coppi. Yeah, Fausto Coppi was an Italian rider who added both races on 2 occasions in 1949 and 1952. The next to achieve that would be Jacques Anquetil in 1964. And of course, you know, when we talk about records, and here it comes, we can't forget about Eddy Merckx, because Eddy Merckx not only won it in 1970, but he also won both of them in 1972, and he also won it in 1974. So he is the rider who has achieved it the most times, back to the earlier trivia question on that. Eddie, good old Eddie, Eddie the Cannibal. In the 80s, another of the mythical cyclists, the Badger, achieved a double in 82 and 85. The Badger, who's the Badger? How come they don't mention his name? I'm trying to remember who we used to call the Badger, and I can't think of it.
I'll find it for you.
Yeah, find that one for me, Franny. During these years, another cyclist would also be able to win the Giro and the Tour. We're talking about Stephen Roche in 1987.
That's Bernardino
was the Badger. Thank you. I knew that. Yeah, Bernardino was the Badger, and he won it in 82 and 85. And yeah, a lot of times these guys get nicknames. Eddy Merckx was the Cannibal because he ate everyone alive. And that's what he was.
What's my nickname?
Your nickname. I don't know if I want to do that on the air, because it could turn into a permanent discussion, and I don't want to get myself in trouble.
I thought I was the locomotor, the diesel train or something like
that. You do have a way of, I will say, Fran has a talent for starting a ride slow and finishing a ride really strong. She's that, you know, she is a diesel engine at the end of a ride. She has been doing that for years. I think it's because we stop usually on a ride that Fran's on, and she has a little bit of caffeine.
Not always,
but a lot of times.
I think it's true of me even when on a ride where I don't stop.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone can hear you because you're so far away from the mic, Franny. Mm-hmm. So if you want to chime in, mm-hmm. but I think it has a lot to do with the caffeine intake too, because she responds incredibly well to caffeine when she's on her bike. It's kind of amazing. So Stephen Roche in 87 was the next one, and then the next one. Year left bitter taste for Spanish cycling, as it meant the defeat in the final stage of the race for Pedro Delgado, who came very close that year to conquering the French round. So he missed out on it. In the 90s, another of the great cyclists in history stands out, Miguel Indurain, who practically introduced the Italian race to the Spanish public at a time it was difficult to follow the Transalpine race on television. Indurain won the pink jersey on 2 occasions and then the yellow jersey in Paris in 92 and 93. So twice Indurain won. The great Italian climber Marco Pantani, in a particularly turbulent year for the sport that led the scandal of the Festina team during the Tour de France, and he also won it. Those who have faced participation in both have ended up surrendering in the second due to the accumulated fatigue, or conversely not performing optimally in the first one due to the need to arrive slightly undertrained in order not to collapse later in the French round. So it's an amazingly difficult thing to achieve, because you have maybe 45 days of downtime in between the two tours. And when you think about 20 days, 21 days of high intensity racing, to be able to hold that jersey and to be able to win is kind of an amazing thing. So Tadej Pogačar, he's the one. He pulled it off. He pulled off that. Now if Tadej wants to chase down a couple of more famous cyclists, people are starting to already talk about him being the next Eddie Merckx, to being as good as Eddie Merckx ever was. He's got a big checklist in front of him before he's going to show up and become better than or equal to Eddie Merckx, in my eyes. There's a lot of classics that he needs to win still, and he's got to win the Tour de France and the Giro three years. That's really, really, really hard to do, especially in today's racing, because there's so many high-performance teams involved and all. We'll see.
And the science is just so much better.
And the science is better. It really is. So there's a lot of factors involved here, but the performance that he put on this year is fairly outstanding. By the way, if you're watching bike racing and now we're getting ready to watch the Olympics, he is competing for Slovenia in the Olympics. So there's a possibility he could win an Olympic title. There's a possibility he could win a world championship title too, if he keeps going this strong. But, you know, at some point the body must fatigue. It needs the rest. And if you're not careful about it, then you're going to get yourself in a lot of trouble. So we'll see. We'll see. Maybe there's a plan here. Maybe they've got maybe they're really watching him carefully. As some people are suspecting, maybe there's better living through science. We don't know. We're trying not to think that way because we are hoping that that is a piece of our past in bicycle racing, but it is sport, and sport is sport, and things happen in sport, and it's not just bicycle racing. So anyway, I thought that was kind of fun, and I wanted to bring all that up. Marco Pantani, boy, he was a lot of fun. He was just a great one to watch. He was such a great climber, great Italian climber. Unfortunately, Marco Pantani could not the one mountain that he could not climb was his mental health, and so Marco is no longer with us, and that was a very, very unfortunate thing. Anyway, now we're heading on to what's next, the Vuelta a España. Fran, look up the Vuelta for me and give me a date on that if you could, please.
Sure. The Tour de France Femme starts on August 12th and goes through August 18th, and it's in France and the Netherlands.
Okay, the 12th through the 18th is the Tour de Femme, okay? Uh-huh. And when is the Vuelta a España?
It is Saturday, August 17th through Sunday, September 8th.
Saturday, August 17th.
It's entirely in Spain.
Same day as the Steeplechase Bike Tour. So yeah, it's too close to try to pull off a triple crown. But if Tadej Pogačar shows up to the Vuelta a España, I'm gonna start getting suspicious. That's all I can say. I don't think he will. I doubt it'll happen. But anyway, that pretty much covers a lot of what I wanted to talk about today on Bicycle Talk. So I am going to move on because I don't really want to use up any more of our time. I'm going to go right into our events page, and I'm going to go right to the Quiet Corner Bike Tour, which is presented by the Thread City Cyclers, our local club right here, on Sunday, July 28th of 2024. That means it is coming up this Sunday. So if you are interested in this and you would like to ride in it, please, you know, join us. Please join us. We've got, let's see, how are we doing here? I got a website here and all. It's right here, Quiet Corner Bike Tour. So there's ride with GPS routes. We've got a 100-mile ride. It's a 102-mile century ride. There's a 64-mile ride. There's a 40-mile ride. And there's a 20-mile ride. We will be previewing those rides this weekend on Saturday, just before the ride. We like to do that. Our club rides, our Saturday club rides, tend to We want to kind of mirror the and check the courses out and make sure they look good and all that before the day before. So our club rides will be going that way. There's also an 18-mile gravel loop on this ride too. So it's going to be 8 miles of the airline trail with one rest stop. So it's not a lot of dirt. It's only 8 miles. But anyway, that is all available too. So we have lots of things going on. It will begin at the Edward Garrison Park at 495 Phoenixville Road, Route 198 in Chaplin, Connecticut. And it is available on Bike Reg. You can go to Bike Reg and sign up there. I believe you can also sign up the day of the event. That's not a problem. We have a lot of people that do that too. And we are currently looking at, there are 74 people signed up for the ride at this time. So we usually get a bunch more just before as people look at weather and all that. So
weather's supposed to be good. It's going to be a high of low 80s.
High of low 80s, Fran says, yes, for the weather. So that would be really nice and no rain. So if you're looking for a great ride and you want to see some of the coolest roads out there, we pride ourselves in the fact that we live in a really beautiful spot. Come out and see us. And, you know, one thing that Fran was commenting on yesterday when we were out and about is that we've got so much more green coverage this year because of all the rain. The canopy's really, really beautiful. It's gorgeous. It's really, really nice out here. So anyway, that is the Quiet Corner Bicycle Tours, and that is this Sunday. So please come out and visit. We would love to see you. Other things that are coming up, the 2024 Steeplechase Ride Walk Saturday, August 17th. That is road rides, including a 20, a 35, and a 62-mile ride, a 5-mile fundraising walk, in addition to last year's 18-mile gravel ride. There's also an additional 40-mile gravel route, which is available, which is 90% dirt roads and trails. So kind of cool. Anyway, I'll constantly be talking about that because I am involved in that ride and I have been for a number of years. Project Mayhem Cyclocross Series coming this fall. As a matter of fact, I've had some scrambling that's had to be done, and I thank Jed for postponing his race until another year. I feel bad about that, but he said it wasn't a problem. And the Mansfield Hollow Cyclocross race is going to be in early September this year, which is a first. We're going to be the season opener. So I will tell you more about that too. It's coming up in a couple of months. I've just got approval from the state. Everything's going to happen. We're going to be able to pull this off. So anyway, we'll talk more about that in the future. Project Mayhem cyclocross races there's going to be 8 of them in the series. Very, very exciting. Really interesting, cool things going on here. So, finishing points. I bring up that congestion pricing in New York City all the time. It's so stupid. It's so anti-productive. And look at Boston. They're giving away free fares on their mass transit. What a difference. Pay attention, New York. Pay attention. Terrible. But hey, Tour de France is over. I'm going to go through a little withdrawal here. But
it's going to be Christmas soon.
It's going to be Christmas soon, Fran just said. that's really not funny. But anyway, yeah. So what's next? We got the Tour de Femme coming up. We've got the Vuelta España coming up. So we got some big races coming up there. And then lots of local stuff right now, including those, the ride coming up this weekend. So hope to see you there. So 2024, what's on your list? More miles, ride and commute to work or around town? I did that today. Better fitness or simply enjoy the bicycle rides you take more by slowing down and smelling the roses? I'll say it again. It won't be my last time. Get loud, get active. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic, dangerous roads, the price of gas, and lack of places to safely ride. And ride your bicycle instead. Take a day and just ride your bike. Park the car and the truck. You might just surprise yourself. The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. You have been listening to Bicycle Talk with my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. If you're watching on Facebook Live, you can leave a comment down here below. And otherwise, you can send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. This is Pedal and Ron. Remember, keep that rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It really could save your life. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Get on your-